Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that's acknowledging extraordinary people who write, read, and shape the world through their extraordinary stories. All this and more at colehaan.com. In this episode, we bring you the sublime work of Mary Oliver, read to you beautifully by the poet herself. Oliver's work redirects the reader to experience the incredible beauty and mystery in the small and ordinary things that surround us in nature, the trees, the rocks, and the animal world. She opens her talk by saying, quote, "My work is loving the world," and later on asks us, quote, "What is it that you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" We are extremely fortunate to have hosted Oliver in 2008 because she was a deeply private person who nonetheless came alive at the podium, not only in reading her poetry, but also through revealing details about her life and work. She wrote more than 30 collections of poetry and nonfiction and won many prizes, including a Pulitzer and a National Book Award. And though she studied at both Ohio State and Vassar, she never completed a college degree. This small biographic detail speaks to the way in which Oliver was a quiet maverick who in her life and work followed few of the rules. Mary Oliver died on January 17, 2019, at the age of 83. Here's Oliver.
I'm going to read tonight from probably about an hour from several books and read around in them. There's a book coming out in April. I'll read some new things. I will read from what I call Molly's book, The Book of Photographs. I guess I'll have to check, skip the line about the chicken running away. But I'm going to begin with a poem from the book Thirst, which is called Messenger. My work is loving the world. Here the sunflowers, there the hummingbird, equal seekers of sweetness. Here the quickening yeast, there the blue plums. Here the clam deep in the speckled sand. Are my boots old? Is my coat torn? Am I no longer young and still not half perfect? Let me keep my mind on what matters, which is my work, which is mostly standing still and learning to be astonished. The Phoebe, the delphinium, the sheep in the pasture, and the pasture, which is mostly rejoicing since all the ingredients are here, which is gratitude to be given a mind and a heart and these body clothes, a mouth with which to give shouts of joy to the moth and the wren, to the sleepy dug-up clam telling them all, over and over, how it is that we live forever. I have a little fellow waiting for me at home whose name is Percy. He has 4 feet. And I like to read always a couple of Percy poems. I have lots of them, but I'll just read a few. This is Percy 1. Our new dog, named for the beloved poet, ate a book which unfortunately we had left unguarded. Fortunately, it was the Bhagavad Gita, of which many copies are available. Every day now, as Percy grows into the beauty of his life, we touch his wild, curly head and say, "Oh, wisest of little dogs." That's my boy. When you start getting old, if you're lucky, you have lots of books. You have to look around a little bit. This is a poem called The Swan. And there's a mention in it of Mrs. Blake, who was the wife of the poet William Blake. Across the wide waters, something comes floating. A slim and delicate ship filled with white flowers. And it moves on its miraculous muscles as though time didn't exist. As though bringing such gifts to the dry shore was a happiness almost beyond bearing. And now it turns its dark eyes. It rearranges the clouds of its wings. It trails an elaborate webbed foot, the color of charcoal. Soon it will be here. Oh, what shall I do when that poppy-colored beak rests in my hand? Said Mrs. Blake of the poet, I miss my husband's company. He is so often in paradise. Of course, the path to heaven doesn't lie down in flat miles. It's in the imagination with which you perceive this world and the gestures with which you honor it. Oh, what will I do? What will I say when those white wings touch the shore? I must always read at least one prose poem. I never wrote prose poems, and then when I was teaching, I thought I had a good idea. Oh, I'll make the kids write prose poems. Then I'll find out if they know what sentences are. So it seemed only fair. They're fun to do. This one is called Beans, B-E-A-N-S, Beans. They're not like peaches or squash. Plumpness isn't for them. They like being lean, as if for the narrow path. The beans themselves sit quietly inside their green pods. Instinctively, one picks with care, never tearing down the fine vine, never not noticing their crisp bodies or feeling their willingness for the pot, for the fire. I have thought sometimes that something, I can't name it, watches as I walk the rows, accepting the gift of their lives to assist mine. I know what you think. This is foolishness. They're only vegetables. Even the blossoms with which they begin are small and pale, hardly significant. Our hands, our minds, our feet hold more intelligence. With this, I have no quarrel. But what about virtue? This is from Thirst also. It's called Swimming with Otter. I am watching Otter, how he plays in the water, how he displays brave underside to the wave washings, how he breathes in descent, trailing sudden strings of pearl that tell almost, but never quite, where he is apt to rise, how he is gone, gone so long I despair of him, then he trims wetly up the far shore, and if he looks back, he is surely laughing. I too have taken myself into this summer lake, where the leaves of the trees almost touch, where peace comes in the generosity of water. And I have reached out into the loveliness, and I have floated on my flat back to think out a poem or two, not by any means fluid, but, dear God, as you have made me, my only quickness. An old poem that usually if I don't read it, I don't get out alive. Wild Geese. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Another Percy poem, but don't worry, it's only going to be three. This is Percy 2. When I get home, he's going to say, "How many poems about me did you read?" And what do I get for it? I have a little dog who likes to nap with me. He climbs on my body and puts his face in my neck. He is sweeter than soap. He is more wonderful than a diamond necklace, which can't even bark. I would like to take him to Kashmir and the Ukraine and Jerusalem and Palestine and Iraq and Darfur, that the sorrowing thousands might see his laughing mouth. I would like to take him to Washington, right into the Oval Office, where Donald Rumsfeld would crawl out of the president's armpit. And kneel down on the carpet and romp like a boy, for once, for a moment, a rational man. That's my Percy. This is a poem actually from a sequence, so the title is really the first line, which is, "There you were, and it was like spring." There you were, and it was like spring, like the first fair water with the light on it hitting the eyes. Why are we made the way we are made, that to love is to want? Well, you are gone now, and this morning I have walked out to the back shore, to the ocean which, even if we think we have measured it, has no final measure. Sometimes you can see the great whales there breaching and playing. Sometimes the swans linger just long enough for us to be astonished. Then they lift their wings, they become again a part of the untouchable clouds. The business of, if it's a business, the desire to get people to read poems who are not, as you might say, pre-converted, is interesting. I so often, people who are used to reading long articles, well, I see them in the airplane and places. They start a poem and they read a sentence or so, and then they turn the page. And I tried to think a long time ago what would help them to stay in the poem. And certainly anybody who starts a sentence has the curiosity to finish that one sentence, yes? And this is why I've kind of done what you can do with dashes and semicolons and so forth. And a good number of my poems are 36 lines long and one sentence. This is called The Sun. Have you ever seen anything in your life more wonderful than the way the sun, every evening, relaxed and easy, floats toward the horizon and into the clouds or the hills or the rumpled sea and is gone? And how it slides again out of the blackness every morning on the other side of the world, like a red flower streaming upward on its heavenly oils, say on a morning in early summer, at its perfect imperial distance? And have you ever felt for anything such wild love? Do you think there is anywhere in any language a word billowing enough for the pleasure that fills you as the sun reaches out, as it warms you, as you stand there empty-handed? Or have you too turned from this world? Or have you too gone crazy for power, for things? Another older poem called Peonies. This morning, the green fists of the peonies are getting ready to break my heart as the sun rises, as the sun strokes them with his old buttery fingers and they open pools of lace, white and pink, and all day the black ants climb over them, boring their deep and mysterious holes into the curls, craving the sweet sap, taking it away to their dark underground cities. And all day, under the shifty wind, as in a dance to the great wedding, the flowers bend their bright bodies and tip their fragrance to the air and rise their red stems, holding all that dampness and recklessness gladly and lightly. And there it is again, beauty, the brave, the exemplary, blazing open. Do you love this world? Do you cherish your humble and silky life? Do you adore the green grass with its terror underneath? Do you also hurry half-dressed and barefoot into the garden and softly, an exclaiming of their dearness, fill your arms with the white and pink flowers, with their honeyed heaviness, their lush trembling, their eagerness to be wild and perfect for a moment before they are nothing forever? I want to read some sections from the book called Our World, which is the book of a memoir of my years with Molly Cook and of her photographs primarily. The photographs, well, as I read, I think you'll understand a little bit, are not all together, but are mostly of people, many people that are well known. Motherwell is here, Mailer is here, Lorraine Hansberry is here, Walker Evans, people that she knew, but also people she did not know. And I think as I read, I'm going to read about six excerpts. It will explain why this is so. Though you have known someone for more than 40 years, though you have worked with them and lived with them, you do not know everything. I do not know everything, but a few things which I will tell. M had will and wit and probably too much empathy for others. She was quick in speech, and she did not suffer fools. When you knew her, she was unconditionally kind. But also, as our friend, the Bishop Tom Shaw, said at her memorial service, you had to be brave to get to know her. Trust was not greatly at her service, but loyalty was. Narrative offers insight. When M was a small child, someone asked her what she wanted to do when she grew up, and she answered, I want to see every face in America. She was born in 1925 in San Francisco. It was not the most fortunate beginning. Years later, she searched for and found her parents. But for many years, she was moved through various temporary homes, a childhood of mystery and insufficiency. It is not hard to guess the reason she wanted to see faces, to find someone somewhere who would be recognizable, would look like her. Dour she could be, but privately. She was Irish, after all, and liked to sing and to have a good time. Occasionally, over the years, she would phone a friend she had met in Europe. She would put records on the phonograph, the old songs they both knew, and they would sing along together, long distance, and not necessarily briefly. She loved cars and liked to drive fast. She learned to fly in a single-engine Cessna. One day, as we were driving up the highway, she called out, "Stop, there's my boat." No matter she had never driven a boat, no matter that this one came with a 190 horsepower engine, we bought it. She was style. She was an old loneliness that nothing could quite wipe away. She was vastly knowledgeable about people, about books, about the mind's emotions and the hearts. She lived sometimes in a black box of memories and unanswerable questions, and then would come out and frolic, be feisty and bold. In some consideration of my writings, a reviewer once surmised that I must have a private income of some substance, since all I ever seemed to do in my poems was wander around Provincetown's woods and its dunes and its long beaches. It was a silly surmise. Looking at the world was one of the important parts of my life, and so that is what I did. It was as simple as that. Poets, if they ever make a living from their writings, do not do so when they are first beginning to publish, and this was years ago. We did not, as I have said before, have much income. We had work and love and play instead. I must do it again. I remember one evening making rice. Rice with chickens and almonds, I said to M as I set the bowls on the table. Only the almonds are imaginary and the chicken ran away. You get that twice. And again, Elizabeth really picked them. It has frequently been remarked about my own writings that I emphasize the notion of attention. This began simply enough to see that the way the flicker flies is greatly different from the way the swallow plays in the golden air of summer. It was my pleasure to notice such things. It was a good first step. But later, watching M when she was taking photographs, and watching her in the darkroom, and no less watching the intensity and openness with which she dealt with friends and strangers too, taught me what real attention is about. Attention without feeling, I began to learn, is only a report. And openness and empathy was necessary if the attention was to matter. Such openness and empathy M had in abundance and gave away freely. All the years I knew her, she had this gift, which is also sometimes a burden with our life friends, with me, and with the faces and even the objects that found their way into her pictures. I was in my late 20s and early 30s and well filled with a sense of my own thoughts, my own presence. I was eager to address the world of words, to address the world with words. Then M instilled in me this deeper level of looking and working, of seeing through the heavenly visibles to the heavenly invisibles. I think of this always when I look at her photographs, the images of vitality, hopefulness, endurance, kindness, vulnerability. Her world certainly wasn't daisies or birds or trees as mine was. We each had our separate natures, yet our ideas, our influence upon each other, became a rich and abiding confluence. And I thought I would read two or three excerpts from her journals, some of which I've also put in this book. Mary, excited, has run down the street looking for a pair of swans. I wish her good luck. She has been thinking about swans for a couple of days, and lo and behold, as they say, someone told her this morning there were indeed two swans in the harbor. Eureka, I'd say. May I have the luck that she has on the wishing pole? I'll not name my wish now. As mentioned, perhaps, she found Linda out their way and is showing her the swans. Indeed, like two mad women, they are chasing up the street, shouting, out of the way, out of the way. We search for swans. We had always lots of animals in our house. NJ was a little cat named Norma Jean. She was supposed to turn into Marilyn, but her eyes were crossed. And Jasper was one of our dogs. Outside the door, NJ is screaming again, this time from the outside, seaward, and it's windy today. I open the door and let the voice in the house once again. She climbs now up to Jasper for comfort. Comfort. Someone to hug is what she is screaming for. Nothing different from any other living soul. Here's a one-liner. People travel to keep from crying in place. And I'll finish with one more. In all our time together, we were rarely separated. Three or four times I went away to teach, but usually Em would come with me, and we simply made our home temporarily somewhere else. And while I always loved the stillness I found in the fields and the woods, our house was a different thing, and I loved that too. We were talkers about our work, our pasts, our friends, our ideas ordinary and far-fetched. We would often wake before there was light in the sky and make coffee and let our minds rattle our tongues. We would end in exhaustion and elation. Not many nights or early mornings later, we would do the same. It was a 40-year conversation. This is called A Pretty Song. It's from Thirst. From the complications of loving you, I think there is no end or return, no answer, no coming out of it. Which is the only way to love, isn't it? This isn't a playground. This is earth or heaven for a while. Therefore, I have given precedence to all my sudden, sullen, dark moods that hold you in the center of my world. And I say to my body, grow thinner still. And I say to my fingers, type me a pretty song. And I say to my heart, rave on. This is called Gethsemane. This also is from Thirst. The grass never sleeps, or the roses, nor does the lily have a secret eye that shuts until morning. Jesus said, wait with me, but the disciples slept. The cricket has such splendid fringe on its feet, and it sings, have you noticed, with its whole body, and heaven knows if it ever sleeps. Jesus said, wait with me. And maybe the stars did. Maybe the wind wound itself into a silver tree and didn't move. Maybe the lake far away, where once he walked as on a blue pavement, lay still and waited wild awake. Oh, the dear body slumped and eyes shut that could not keep that vigil. How they must have wept, so utterly human, knowing this too must be a part of the story. Praying. It doesn't have to be the blue iris. It could be weeds in a vacant lot, or a few small stones. Just pay attention. Then patch a few words together, and don't try to make them elaborate. This isn't a contest, but the doorway into thanks and a silence in which another voice may speak. I want to read a few poems from the book that will be out in April, which is called Redbird. This is called Iraq. I want to sing a song for a body I saw crumpled and without a name, but clearly someone young who had not yet lived his life and never would. How shall I do this? What kind of song would serve such a purpose? This poem may never end, for what answer does it have for anyone in this distant, comfortable country simply looking on? Clearly, he had a weapon in his hands. I think he could have been no more than 20. I think whoever he was, of whatever country, he might have been my brother with a world different. I think he would not have been lying there with a world different. I think if I had known him on his birthday, I would have made for him a great celebration. Small bodies. It is almost summer. In the pond, the pickerel leap, and the delicate teal have brought forth their many charming young, and the turtle is ravenous. It is hard sometimes, O Lord, to be faithful. I am more boldly made than the little ducks paddling and laughing, but not so bold as the turtle with his greasy mouth. I know you know everything. I rely on this. Still, there are so many small bodies in the world for which I am afraid. Meadowlark sings, and I greet him in return. Meadowlark, when you sing, it's as if you lay your yellow breast upon mine and say, hello, hello. And are we not of one family in our delight of life? You sing, I listen. Both are necessary. If the world is to continue going around, night heavy, then light laden, though not everyone knows this, or at least not yet, or perhaps has forgotten it in the torn fields, in the terrible debris of progress. Showing the birds. Look, children, here is the shy, flightless dodo, the many-colored pigeon named the passenger, the great auk, the Eskimo curler, curlew, the woodpecker called the Lord God bird, the... Come, children, hurry. There are so many more wonderful things to show you in the museum's dark drawers. This is called Red. All the while I was teaching in the state of Virginia, I wanted to see Gray Fox. Finally, I found him. He was in the highway. He was singing his death song. I picked him up and carried him into a field while the cars kept coming. He showed me how he could ripple, how he could bleed. Goodbye, I said to the light of his eye as the cars went by. 2 mornings later, I found the other. She was in the highway. She was singing her death song. I picked her up and carried her into the field where she rippled half of her gray, half of her red, while the cars kept coming, while the cars kept coming. Gray fox and gray fox, red, red, red. Those are kind of melancholy, aren't they? This is called Winter in the Nuthatch. Once or twice, and maybe again, who knows, the timid nuthatch will come to me if I stand still with something good to eat in my hand. The first time he did it, he landed smack on his belly as though the legs wouldn't cooperate. The next time he was bolder. Then he became absolutely wild about those walnuts. But there was a morning I came late, and guess what? The nuthatch was flying into a stranger's hand. To speak plainly, I felt betrayed. I wanted to say, "Mister, that nuthatch and I have a relationship." It took hours of standing in the snow before he would drop from the tree and trust my fingers, but I didn't say anything. Nobody owns the sky or the trees. Nobody owns the hearts of birds. Still, being human and partial, therefore, to my own successes, though not resentful of others fashioning theirs, I'll come tomorrow, I believe, quite early. What is this from? This is from West Wind. And it's called, "Have You Ever Tried to Enter the Long Black Branches?" Have you ever tried to enter the long black branches of other lives? Tried to imagine what the crisp fringes full of honey hanging from the branches of the young locust trees in early summer feel like? Do you think this world is only an entertainment for you? Never to enter the sea and notice how the water divides with perfect courtesy to let you in. Never to lie down on the grass as though you were the grass. Never to leap to the air as you open your wings over the dark acorn of your heart. No wonder we hear in your mournful voice the complaint that something is missing from your life. Who can open the door who does not reach for the latch? Who can travel the miles who does not put one foot in front of the other, all attentive to what presents itself continually? Who will behold the inner chamber who has not observed with admiration, even with rapture, the outer stone? Well, there is time left. Fields everywhere invite you into them. And who will care? Who will chide you if you wander away from wherever you are to look for your soul? Quickly then, get up, put on your coat, leave your desk. To put one's foot into the door of the grass, which is the mystery, which is death as well as life, and not be afraid. To set one's foot in the door of death and be overcome with amazement. To sit down in front of the weeds and imagine God the ten-fingered sailing out of his house of straw, nodding this way and that way to the flowers of the present hour, to the song falling out of the mockingbird's pink mouth, to the tiplets of the honeysuckle that have opened in the night. To sit down like a weed among weeds and rustle in the wind. Listen, are you breathing just a little and calling it a life? While the soul, after all, is only a window, and the opening of the window no more difficult than the wakening from a little sleep. Only last week I went out among the thorns and said to the wild roses, deny me not, but suffer my devotion. Then all afternoon I sat among them. Maybe I even heard a curl or two of music, damp and rouge red, hurrying from their stubby buds, from their delicate, watery bodies. For how long will you continue to listen to those dark shouters, caution and prudence? Fall in, fall in. A woman standing in the weeds. A small boat flounders in the deep waves, and what's coming next is coming with its own heave and grace. Meanwhile, once in a while, I have chanced among the quick things upon the immutable. What more could one ask? And I would touch the faces of the daisies, and I would bow down to think about it. That was then, which hasn't ended yet. Now the sun begins to swing down. Under the peach light, I cross the fields and the dunes. I follow the ocean's edge. I climb, I backtrack, I float. I ramble my way home. This is called A Summer Day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean, the one who has flung herself out of the grass, the one who is eating sugar out of my hand, who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down, who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I have been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And I think I'm going to read three more poems. What happens to the leaves after they turn red and golden and fall away? What happens to the singing birds when they can't sing any longer? What happens to their quick wings? Do you think there is any personal heaven for any of us? Do you think anyone, the other side of that darkness, will call to us, meaning us? Beyond the trees, the foxes keep teaching their children to live in the valley. So they never seem to vanish. They are always there in the blossom of light that stands up every morning in the dark sky. And over one more set of hills along the sea, the last roses have opened their factories of sweetness and are giving it back to the world. If I had another life, I would want to spend it all on some unstinting happiness. I would be a fox or a tree full of waving branches. I wouldn't mind being a rose in a field full of roses. Fear has not yet occurred to them, nor ambition. Reason they have not yet thought of. Neither do they ask how long they must be roses, and then what? Or any other foolish question. And see, volume two. Percy once more, and then a last poem. Percy, Percy. This one has a title. It's called Little Dog's Rhapsody in the Night. He puts his cheek against mine and makes small expressive sounds. And when I'm awake or awake enough, he turns upside down his four paws in the air and his eyes dark and fervent. Tell me you love me, he says. Tell me again. Oh. Could there be a sweeter arrangement? Over and over, he gets to ask, I get to tell. And I'll finish with a poem called White Heron Rises Over Blackwater. I wonder what it is that I will accomplish today, if anything can be called that marvelous word. It won't be my kind of work, which is only putting words on a page, the pencil haltingly calling up the light of the world, yet nothing appearing on paper half as bright as the mockingbird's verbal hilarity in the still unleafed shrub in the churchyard, or the white heron rising over the swamp and the darkness, his yellow eyes and broad wings wearing the light of the world in the light of the world. Ah, yes, I see him. He is exactly the poem I wanted to write. Thank you.
That was Mary Oliver speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2008. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Support for the Archive Project comes from Cole Haan, the fashion brand that aims to inspire and empower people to live an extraordinary life. All this and more at colehaan.com. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.